This is The Takeaway for Monday, November 13th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and Roy Moore says he's not going anywhere.
I have not been guilty of sexual misconduct with anyone.
The Republican Senate candidate from Alabama says the on-the-record story from a woman that Moore initiated a sexual encounter with her when she was 14 years old is a lie. Meanwhile, Breitbart News, led once again by President Trump's former strategist Steve Bannon, has dispatched its employees to Alabama in an attempt to discredit the stories that Lee Korfman and other women told to The Washington Post. Yesterday, Breitbart ran an article revealing that Washington Post reporters convinced Lee Korfman to come forward with her story. In other words, Breitbart News accuses The Washington Post of reporting. Some Republicans in Washington say that Lee Korfman is simply more credible than Roy Moore and that he should get out of the race. But here's the front runner to be the Republican Senate nominee in Virginia next year, conservative Corey Stewart on Facebook.
I think it's wrong to be just assuming that somebody's guilty, especially from allegations that are 40 years old.
Such is the reaction to allegations of child molestation against the Republican Party's nominee in Alabama. Polls suggest Roy Moore is now in a dead heat with Democrat Doug Jones, with that special election a month away. Pat Duggins has been keeping us up to date with all the maneuverings in Alabama. Pat is news director at Alabama Public Radio. Pat, thanks for coming back.
Hi, Todd, and the hits just keep on coming.
They really do from down there in Alabama. Pat, what's been the reaction now that Lee Korfman's allegations have had a weekend and a little bit of time to sink in?
Well, I guess the newest part, Todd, is the fact that Roy Moore is now suing the Washington Post. If I were a member of the Doug Jones camp, I would be licking my chops and thanking the Lord on high, because that would mean that even more of Roy Moore's record will now come out, because up to now, Moore has been meticulously avoiding debates with Doug Jones, but all this media coverage is having all these details come out.
Yeah, lawsuits usually mean discovery. We'll see if he actually pursues that before Election Day on December 12th. Look, Pat, Roy Moore is a guy who spent his political career talking about religious morality, long crusades against Islam, gay people, sexual immorality. Is anyone in Alabama seeing him as hypocritical now?
Well, I'm having Robert Bentley flashbacks, because if you'll recall, you know, when Governor Robert Bentley was elected, within 12 hours of his taking the oath of office, he was in the pulpit of a Baptist church telling a whole group of international reporters that if you have not accepted Jesus Christ as your savior, you're not my brother. The message, directly or indirectly, true or untrue, being I represent some people in Alabama, but not others. And so there was a whole collection of uncomplimentary news reports that resulted in that. And then if you go, what, halfway through his second term, he was tape recorded making sexually explicit comments to a woman who was not his wife. And so all of a sudden, all of that Christian rhetoric kind of goes out the window. And you have to wonder, you know, Roy Moore's supporters are lead pipe behind him. There are some that are even saying, we don't care if Lee Korfman's allegations are true. She's the 14-year-old girl who claimed that Roy Moore molested her back in 1979. They don't care if it's true. They're going to vote for him anyway.
So not a question of whether they believe Lee Korfman or not. It doesn't matter if he made sexual advances on a 14-year-old.
It could either be because they would never vote for a Democrat, or because with, you know, evangelical voters, you have this, you know, the issues of, you know, redemption and forgiveness. So even if he did all this, even if he was thrown out of office twice, which he was, even if he's an alleged child molester, which the Washington Post says that he is, there's that forgiveness. And it would take more than that to really turn them against him.
Pat, some Republican officials in Alabama have suggested over the weekend maybe suspending the election and moving the date, sort of canceling an election they think they might lose. Is that novel idea getting any currency, or do they not have to do that now if it's evident that so many of Roy Moore's supporters are still behind him?
Well, there's a two-part answer to that. Number one, Governor Kay Ivey says that she will not move the election. There are some observers who say, well, the reason that she set the special election for mid-December was to prevent Roy Moore from running for governor when Kay Ivey was trying to get her first full term in office after the resignation of Governor Robert Bentley. And on the other, quite frankly, the concern among the Democrats is that all of this stuff coming out from the Post and all of these comments from Mitch McConnell are simply going to galvanize conservative voters in Alabama. They're just going to, you know, fold their arms and stamp their feet and say, well, I'm just going to stick my thumb in the eye of all of these, you know, godless northern liberal bedwetters, and I'm just going to vote for Roy Moore anyway.
Pat, there's also kind of a fantasy coming out of Washington. In fact, I don't know if it's a fantasy or if it's some hopeful whispering that maybe a Luther Strange write-in campaign could win this election, that maybe somebody who's more amenable to Washington Republicans could still have a chance.
That's one scenario. Another scenario I'm hearing is that assuming Roy Moore stays in and assuming Roy Moore wins, which if you take a look at the latest polling, is not necessarily a given, that they could simply refuse to seat him in the Senate. Apparently, there is some kind of chicanery they can do to not seat him. And then all of a sudden, Governor Kay Ivey gets to name whoever else she wants, obviously a Republican, that would fill that seat. It could be Luther Strange. It could be Mo Brooks, who was kind of pushed out of the running earlier, despite all of the publicity he was getting following the softball Congress shooting up in Washington.
Yeah, it's Congressman Mo Brooks. Pat, before we let you go, is there any effect in Alabama of all these Republicans in Washington who say that Roy Moore should step aside? Mitch McConnell has said that if the allegations are true, Roy Moore should step aside. That, of course, gives Roy Moore the space to keep saying that the allegations are lies or fake news. Other senators like Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania have said he should go right now. Does anybody in Alabama listen?
Well, if you look at what the Democrats are doing for Doug Jones, with the exception of Joe Biden coming down for one campaign rally, they're meticulously staying out of this because the concern is that in Alabama, because of, its civil rights history and everything else like that, that there is a tendency among the electorate here to kind of get defensive when people say, you should think this way, you should think this way or consider that. So on the one hand, they're kind of worried about that. And then on the other hand, it's just, Doug Jones seems to be taking a progressive, maybe 1970s, 1980s style track that, okay, Alabama, warts and all, can be better than people say that we are. And to do that, it's a good idea to kind of go progressive. And that's sort of the message that he's pushing, which is where political scientists are saying, oh my gosh, this is not just token Democratic opposition, but Doug Jones not only has a different kind of message, but he also has poll numbers to back it up.
Pat Duggins, Alabama Public Radio. Thanks, Pat.
Thanks, Todd.
The First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs made a habit out of recording their services and then uploading them to YouTube. And that means there was a camera rolling when Devin Kelly walked into the church on November 5th, walked down the pews, and shot people, including children, one after another after another. The FBI has that video, but it hasn't yet released it, and it brings up a familiar debate in a sometimes violent media age America. Should the public see those images? Coming up, we hear from two experts with different ideas.
I am struggling. I spent a lot of my career working on ideas about freedom of information, and I'm sort of coming around to a different place where the concerns for me are outweighing some of the benefits of airing videos like this.
That's Sahara Byrne of Cornell University. She thinks these videos probably shouldn't be released. And also Matthew Grizzard of the University of Buffalo, who says the potential benefits of releasing the footage likely outweighs the risks.
It's not that there aren't costs associated with releasing this footage. It's just that there might also be costs associated with not releasing it.
And you've had a lot to say.
My name is Sharon. I'm calling from Somerville, South Carolina. I think it's the only thing that's going to get people to realize how much damage assault rifles can inflict on people and society as a whole. We need to do something about our gun laws.
Do you think the public should be able to see videos of mass shootings? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Let's continue our discussion now with Matthew Grizzard, Assistant Professor of Communications at the University of Buffalo, and Sahara Byrne, Associate Professor of Media Communication at Cornell University.
My concerns are, from a scientific perspective, I think three of the sort of longstanding theories of media violence have to do with how we learn about behaviors that are possible to enact. We kind of prime ideas about aggression, and we become desensitized, or we don't feel as many physiological reactions that would lead us to kind of avoid some of those behaviors. And along with that is the, I think, anxiety-provoking element. Particularly, I study youth, and so what happens to youth who might see these kinds of videos. And finally, the last thing is the celebritizing, potentially, of behaviors like this.
Copycat reactions and things like that.
Yes, copycat reactions, the desire to be in the spotlight, given some of the mental health issues that I think we all agree come along with some behaviors like this, becoming numb to it, but also this sort of less behavioral idea of just people being afraid to enter a room with other people because this is the type of situation, a concert, a church, a mall, that we have been seeing so many times situations like this occur in.
Matthew, those concerns that Sahara is voicing there, desensitization, even traumatization, copycats, and celebritization of this type of violence, does the research bear out those problems as opposed to maybe the benefits of people seeing the videos?
Well, I think with this type of footage, you're less likely to see the types of imitation and priming just due to the fact that there would be such negative consequences that you would see and feel associated with it.
So talk a little bit more about the research that you've done and that we do have. You've shown people videos of terrorists and some really, really awful things, but studied how they react based on how much they see.
Exactly. We manipulated a news footage clip in a laboratory experiment where we told people about a massacre that was conducted by ISIS. We showed them some of it, but edited out the worst of the violence. And then finally, we showed the unedited clip, and we found that when people see the unedited clip, they feel higher levels of anger and disgust. And those responses motivate desires for change.
Desires for change to get up from in front of the TV and maybe do something about it?
Basically, motivations for humanitarian aid to aid victims, but also military aid to try to potentially stop the terrorism. Now, I think that's debatable whether or not those things are good, but the issue, I think, is, you know, how much do we see and how much does it make us care? Because the costs associated with not seeing this footage, right, is they're harder to see because they're future costs, right? They're people who will eventually become the victims of gun crime if we don't do something to potentially stop it.
All right. Well, we've been hearing from lots and lots of our takeaway listeners on this issue. Matt, listen to this caller who let us know how he feels.
Hi, this is Chris from Millbrae, California. Shows such video only to lawmakers and researchers, not to the general public. This will limit copycat actors and traumatize lawmakers.
Well, Matthew, there's one view. You can get your social change by making lawmakers face the video, maybe without the public downside.
Yeah, I mean, I think lawmakers absolutely should have to watch these videos. They volunteered to be representatives for people, and so they should avail themselves of all potential evidence for making policies. But I think the caller talks about another issue, which is copycatting and media coverage. And Sahara talked a little bit about this, but I think there's two questions that the media really needs to ask when an event like this happens. The first is this newsworthy? And I think this obviously was newsworthy, but once you've decided that the public needs to know about an issue like this, I think it's important to show and portray the full gravity of the situation and not withhold the evidence that could potentially inform the debates that are happening.
Well, here's another takeaway listener.
My name is Laura, and I'm calling from Basking Ridge. Let them see. Remembering Emmett Till and all those people who violently and needlessly die due to guns in America and other mentally disturbed activities, let them see. And just maybe things will change.
Sahara, Emmett Till's mother famously said, let them see, and demanded an open casket and photographs for the body of her son at his funeral. Let them see what they've done to him. Make them face it.
I can understand as a mother how you would come to that conclusion. What makes me nervous is all of this, I think, depends on your point of who you're identifying with when you're viewing a piece of footage like this. And while I think that it could inspire something like gun control, which has been talked about already today as an option, or maybe this would stimulate some more restrictions on firearms, the other possibility is that you have, you know, members of, for example, those who cherish their right to have guns, see a video like this and are more deeply ingrained in their philosophy of having a gun would have prevented this from happening if we would have had someone there sooner to stop this shooter.
You know, part of this question, it strikes me, Matt and Sahara, is almost moot. In most cases, for instance, the Las Vegas shooting, there were dozens, hundreds of iPhone videos of parts of that assault. So whether the FBI releases a video was almost moot. In this case, inside the church, there's only one video. You know, Matt, I want to say as a journalist, I will almost always come down on the side of the public's right to know. On the other hand, there's another reality. If this video gets on CNN and Fox, it's probably not going to be shown once or three times with warning and contextualization. It's going to be shown over and over and over and over.
Yes, and I think you're right about that. And I think one of the issues, though, is even if it is shown on CNN or Fox over and over and over again, they're not going to show the most graphic elements of the clip, which I think is really what people need to see. I think it's harder to glorify or think about or not think about an issue when it's smacking you right in the face and there are so many negative consequences associated with it. I think, you know, media violence in general, if we talk about media entertainment violence, it will be considered high-risk content because you often have these attractive perpetrators committing crimes and there's very little in terms of pain cues associated with the violence that's actually enacted. Whereas with these actual real footage, I think it's a very different experience than what most Americans are used to when they think about violence.
Matthew Grizzard is Assistant Professor of Communications at the University of Buffalo. And Sahara Byrne, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Todd.
Sahara Byrne, Associate Professor of Media and Communications at Cornell. There is video of the carnage at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando in 2016. The 2011 attack outside of a Safeway in Tucson that killed 6 people and wounded Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and 13 others is on video too. But the public has never seen any of it. Pam Simon has seen video of Tucson. Pam was one of the victims on that day, and the FBI let her watch footage of her own shooting.
It was a long time before I was able to watch it and decided I needed to do that. And some of the survivors chose not to see it at all.
But should graphic video of mass shootings be released to everyone?
What purpose does it serve? It re-traumatizes the hundreds of thousands of people that have been involved in either a mass shooting or a personal situation. And it only sensationalizes as opposed to helping us move towards a real solution.
Well, one of the arguments that you heard earlier was that this type of raw graphic video might spur people into action. Well, Pam Simon says, no way.
If that would spur us to action, it would have spurred us to action long ago. I think in our society today, we are just so bombarded with violence that, quite frankly, the pictures of an anguished parent's face at a funeral is far more powerful than the video of people running for their lives in the Las Vegas shooting.
Mass shooting survivor Pam Simon, former staffer to Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Well, what do you think? Should you be able to see footage of high-profile violent acts? Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Let's go to Washington now, where everyone is already wondering whether 2018 could be a wave election. Well, there's another wave that's already hitting Republicans. 29 House Republican members have announced they're out, not running for re-election in 2018. And it's not just backbenchers either. Powerful committee chairman like Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, said on Thursday he's not running again. And of course, you've heard about GOP senators like Jeff Flake of Arizona and Bob Corker of Tennessee. So why are Republicans tapping out? Well, there are a lot of reasons, but this is definitely one. Steve Bannon talking to the New York Times last week.
I believe to win, they have to recreate the coalition that won on November 8th of 2016. The Trump agenda will win.
Joining me now is Cheryl Chumley, online opinion editor at The Washington Times. Cheryl, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Todd.
You were an early backer of candidate Trump and President Trump. You must love what you're seeing with Republicans heading for the exits.
Well, I do love the fact that Trump is in the White House. I was an early backer. I am still a backer of Trump. I can't say that I love what's going on in the Republican Party right now. I hate to see Republicans publicly fighting and feuding with other Republicans.
But then when you look at Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, who I mentioned, Judiciary Committee chairman, Jeb Hensarling of Texas, a chairman, Lamar Smith of Texas, a chairman, all who announced their retirements recently, you talk about feuding, but this is people saying they just don't want to be involved anymore.
I don't know if I would characterize it that way. You know, this is not uncommon that politicians don't run for re-election. There is a little bit higher bump in this coming election cycle than has been in the past, but you have to look beyond the numbers and realize that half of those people who are retiring or not seeking re-election from the House are doing so because they're seeking state Senate seats or they're going to run for governors of their states. So it's not exactly an anti-Trump thumbprint that we're seeing here, not yet at least.
And you're saying that this is not necessarily the Bannon strategy of pushing out establishment Republicans, right? But there is the case of Jeff Flake in Arizona, who only a few short years ago, as you know, was considered one of his party's most conservative members.
He was. And, you know, a lot of Republicans still like him. A lot of conservatives who don't like the establishment wing of the Republican Party still like Flake. But at the same time, Flake's being a little disingenuous about his political career here. What happened was he went to D.C. and he voted with Donald Trump on Donald Trump-backed policies, something upwards of 90% of the time. And then he came out, though, and criticized Trump. He wrote a book about it in August that just criticized the whole populism style movement that Trump ushered in. So on one hand, he voted with Trump. On the other hand, he publicly condemned Trump. And that's something which conservative voters, Republican voters have had enough of for some time.
Cheryl, there are congressmen like Charlie Dent, a moderate of central Pennsylvania, who's also not running for re-election. He's from a moderate district in a moderate state, a real swing district. I'm from that district. Is it wise, though, for the Republican Party to be pushing out the Charlie Dents of the world? I mean, a Democrat could well win that seat and probably will.
I don't know if you would say that the Republican Party is pushing out these moderates. You know, Steve Bannon has his own views, but he's just one guy. I would look at it more as a voter-driven effort, a voter-driven activism. I think voters for some time in the Republican Party, conservative, patriotic voters, if you look back on 2010 with the whole Tea Party sweep, they've been frustrated by the establishment Republican wing for such a long time, and they see that Trump finally making it to the White House is giving them a voice in the executive that they haven't had for so long. Conservatives now have a clean sweep of the House, the Senate, and the White House, and they really want to get things done. And I just think saying that Steve Bannon is pushing this, I think it's more the voters are pushing this, voters in the Republican Party, and Steve Bannon is coming forward as a leader of that.
So, Cheryl, you see 29 Republicans so far in the House, a couple more in the Senate on the way out, and you say what?
I say that it's too early to credit this to a rejection of Donald Trump.
Cheryl Chumley, online opinion editor at The Washington Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A lot of people are coming up against the reality that they either have to sign on with Trump or they'll be just going down with the ship. So, you know, it's a couple of bad choices that Republicans are faced with.
David Neiwirth has been following right-wing extremism and white supremacist groups in this country for decades. Well, as Cheryl Chumley just said, not all the Republican retirements from Congress can be pinned on Steve Bannon and President Trump. But David Neiwirth still says, take note, the alt-right is becoming more powerful under President Trump. And he says they're intent on pushing out the moderates, even the establishment conservatives, and instead offering chaos.
They're out there feeding people's fears and stoking people's paranoia and bizarro beliefs. And it's really hard for a Republican anymore to try to rein their own constituents in.
David Neiwirth is author of Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, where he writes about the history of white supremacy and how it mutated and adapted into white nationalism and how the alt-right we talk about today began.
Mostly through the internet. In fact, that is pretty much what the alt-right originally was really this kind of online phenomenon where, yeah, we saw a lot of these very traditional white nationalist, nativist, even neo-Confederate points of view coalescing with some of the newer influences, including, I would say, this very much misogynist culture that has arisen around video gaming. Really, it's predominantly a white male's culture that they believe is under attack. And it's classic right-wing authoritarianism in that they really have a very zero-sum view of this, that, you know, if any other race or any other segment actually makes social gains, and this includes women, then they must be losing, you know, if one side wins and the other side must lose. that's very much their worldview, and it very much informs the sort of fear that they develop. And what they really often do is that they're fomenting fear of these feminists, fear of Latinos, fear of immigrants, fear of anybody that's new or different.
How has all of this kind of interact and interceded with mainstream politicians?
Well, as you know, there's this sort of second universe, and that's really what I call Alt-America, and this alternative universe that they've created for themselves. It's really an epistemological bubble in which Obama did not have a legitimate birth certificate, in which he's secretly Muslim, in which globalist Jews are plotting secretly to enslave the United States. You know, this is part of their worldview. And it's very much an upside-down sort of thing. But Donald Trump very much played into that. And for the people on the alt-right, this is a very heartening development. They listen to Donald Trump. He says all the right things that make them happy. And yet he's astute enough to do it in a way that, you know, allows him plausible deniability about the origins of this stuff and the thought.
So, David, where does all this go, do you think? The internet, of course, isn't going anywhere. Neither are the demographic shifts in America that might have a lot of people in the alt-right universe aggrieved that their way of life is going away. Pluralism as an opposing force isn't going away either. So where does this go?
Well, I don't think there are any easy solutions, and certainly not any top-down solutions. I think ultimately it's going to have to depend on all of us ordinary people making a difference in our personal lives and our personal dealings. I think folks in urban areas need to reassess how they look at people from rural areas, and I think people from rural areas need to have a similar awakening. How we bridge that gap, I don't know. But a lot of these conversations occur over our dinner tables and in our business dealings and in just our everyday relationships. And I think if we can, you know, develop some humility and maybe a different approach to how we talk to each other, I think it's going to make a difference. I mean, really the core thing to me is that Americans need to understand that the far right is, you know, the radical right is profoundly anti-democratic. And it's intent on destroying our democratic institutions. And we need to understand that. These institutions are under assault, and we need to stand up for them. We've kind of taken them for granted. I think we assume that because they've been here for 100 years, chugging along just fine and making life good for most of us, that they will continue. But they are being challenged by a political faction that has every desire to throw them out and replace them with authoritarian rule by a regime led by somebody like Donald Trump.
But on the other hand, are you happy, David Neiwirth, to see several high-profile Republican conservatives saying exactly what you're saying, Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, Mitt Romney, even George W. Bush?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I am glad to see it. I mean, I've been warning that this has been coming on for a long time, so it's heartening to hear other voices joining in. If those voices are standing up and saying something, then I think the rest of us better pay attention.
The book is Alt-America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. David Neiwirth is the author. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Lately, we've been spending a lot of time with police officers from around the country trying to get a closer look at the lives of the men and women working as cops during a time of protest and media scrutiny. It's all part of our series, To Serve and Protect, Life Behind the Blue Line.
There is a war being waged on our police officers.
There's an oppressive force in the way that criminal justice engages with black bodies.
And it becomes unrepairable. It doesn't take a lot for things to spiral out of control.
Put their minds somewhat at ease when they're out here on the streets and not be so aggressive, because they're supposed to protect and serve, not kill us all.
They want to invite for coffee and dinner people who tweet out support of convicted cop killers.
Most of you guys don't know what it's like to be followed in the store for no reason, to be stopped and pulled over for no reason.
It's simply not going to end.
Today we go to St. Louis, right next door to Ferguson, Missouri. St. Louis, in many ways, has come to symbolize the nation's troubled relationship between police officers and the communities they serve.
My name is Heather Taylor. I'm a sergeant with the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. I've been an officer for 17 years. I wanted to be a police officer my entire life. I always loved the uniform. I always loved my connections that I had when I met police officers. I'm currently the president of the Ethical Society of Police. The purpose of the Ethical Society of Police is for us to bridge the gap with communication between the police department and the community. There's a large disconnect throughout the country between the community and officers. Our community, they don't really know what we do internally, and we haven't done a good job with connecting to them. My relationship with the community that I serve, I think it's stellar. It's pretty good. I'm often contacted via email, phone calls at work in regards to what I do, you know, my connections as a homicide sergeant. I think I have a level of empathy that people see that's honest and open, and I'm not afraid to admit when our police department is wrong or when I'm wrong. St. Louis represents, how it is, just about everywhere. The lack of communication consistently with community outreach, with community-oriented policing, it's very strained. We were formed because of racism internally. And you have to understand that the conflicts that you have internally can then become external. Ultimately, the divide is there, and you have this strained relationship, and you disconnect on things that should be something that we should be able to come together for, like crime. You know, a lot of times people are afraid to reach out to us as officers because they don't trust us. You know, I've also had an aunt who was killed by law enforcement in 1992, and I understand the pain and the anguish that goes with that, not knowing and waiting for the facts to come out and not receiving information right away. So when we create our community outreach and organizational division, it's sometimes difficult because you've had systemically over time, you've had issues with police and the community. That level is passed down to generation to generation, and that disconnect just remains. My attitudes about policing have changed a lot, not from the standpoint of being vocal and standing up for what I feel is right. However, I'm not as green and blind to things that are happening around me. I remember as a young officer, I was told I wouldn't get a job because they already had a black female. They didn't need another. You know, I knew it was wrong, but I took it, and it's something that I shouldn't have at the time. I remember when I probably had 7 years on the department, I stood up for something. I filed a complaint against a supervisor, took some heat for it. But as I've progressed in my career, I've been consistent with standing up and trying to do what was right. What happens is that being an African-American and a female, I am looked at as a role model for a lot of women on this department of all races because it's very difficult. I'm the first female sergeant to ever be assigned to homicide. And people look at that as something, as accomplishment. And I look at it as sad. We have a lot of qualified women, both African-American and of all races, that are sergeants that can do this job. And a lot of times, things out of our control prevent us from succeeding within this male-dominated environment. But I have seen that there are some things and some people within law enforcement that won't ever change their views, you know, on both black and white. And a lot of times the good old boys network is in existence in the old school ways of policing. Let's go out and arrest everyone. Let's get them. Let's lock them up. And as my career has progressed, that hasn't worked. We've been locking up people for decades, and we are still the most violent city in the country. So my philosophies have changed towards, you know, yes, I love community-oriented policing then, but I understand it more. I've educated myself about it more in understanding that you can't solve crime without your community. When you have more crime, you have more calls for service. And when you have more violent crime, it takes up more manpower. We are overwhelmed with calls for service for violent crime, gun-related crime. It takes your toll. We're expecting our officers to go from, oh, I just had a kid shot that I carried into the hospital, that I'm going cold and carrying to the hospital. And you're expecting that same officer to then in turn go back on the street and handle a burglary. The mental strain and the mental toll is there. there is a correlation to how we behave sometimes, the stress level and how quick-tempered some officers can be. My job is to be a police officer and to be fair to everyone, regardless of whether I agree with their religion or not, whether I agree with their stance on something or not. And you have to push that forward with your officers. You know, as a detective sergeant, that's what I do. We have to have supervisors push that do your job, that's it. You know, your personal opinion while you're at work is not to come into play like that. And it's ultimately up to that supervisor and having them trained and being consistent with that. Just do your job and be committed to doing your job.
That was Sergeant Heather Taylor of the Metropolitan St. Louis Police Department talking to us in her role as a member of the Ethical Society of Police. And we've been getting lots of your reactions to the state of policing today.
My name is Rich Pinker. I'm calling from Oakland, California. Coming from an urban background and going to school in a suburban area, I always felt that cops were a threat to me in those urban areas. And in the suburban areas, not so much, because you saw officers on foot walking and talking and interacting with the community.
Hi, my name is Joel. I'm from New Jersey. I'm a current police officer in New Jersey. And one thing people don't understand is that police officers deal with people at their worst moments, day in and day out.
Hi, I'm Lakeisha from Vallejo. And I think we do put a lot of pressure on the police. From my point of view, from my community, a lot of people do not really like police. But then on the flip side, I have a father who is in law enforcement, and he was a very upstanding person. It kind of makes me think, you know, if you want to fix something or make something better, you need to join it instead of resist. Because how can the police culture change if the people who live in those communities do not work for those communities? And it would make me feel a lot more comfortable to know that the person protecting these streets' children also lives on them.
You're giving us your voice on the state of policing in your community and the state of policing across America. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to our Facebook page. And don't forget, you can check out the entire series To Serve and Protect. It's on our website at thetakeaway.org/police. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.